So welcome, everyone. Just a moment, we'll continue with our teachings from the Swampland Flowers by the 12th century Chinese Chan Zen master Tahui. But first, we always like to begin with an opportunity. If anyone has any questions about the formal practices we did tonight, the sitting, the walking, the conscious breathing, mindfulness of the body, how to deal with thoughts, strong emotions, etc. Or else, if anyone has any questions in terms of the application of the teachings and the practices into their daily life, we all know that the Buddha said, I only teach to help people eradicate, end their suffering, which implies his only purpose is to help people transcend their suffering so they can lead happy, meaningful, peaceful, compassionate lives. So the Dharma, which is a teaching of the Buddha, is a wonderful toolbox, but oftentimes we don't know what tools are in it, and if we do know, we may not be sure how to work them in relationship to the difficulties that are occurring in our own life. So if anyone has any question, please don't be shy or embarrassed. This is a wonderful opportunity to be free. So anybody have any questions? Yes.
When's the first time I came?
What is your name?
I'm Bobby.
What?
Bobby.
Bobby, yes, Bobby. So the question is Bobby came for the, I'm just doing this for the mic.
I came for the first time.
Right, so Bobby came for the first time, and he's wondering, is this what we do every week? Pretty much at our once a week meetings, variations on a theme, but you know, the practice of living in the present moment and the practice of developing the capacity to sit and to walk in awareness and consciousness and presence is fundamental. I don't know if you've studied the Buddhist teaching, but you know, many, many different kinds of practices, many teachings, but mindfulness is the base. And without a calm, clear mind, it's very difficult to put anything into practice. So this is kind of our foundation. Again, many people have, over time, learned different practices and practiced different things. But I would say the practice of mindfulness is the basic practice. Any other questions? Yes, Dave.
Right. My question comes from generally every about year to 2 years when the pattern is that I start get to a place. And I feel very excited about the place. I want to explore. I want to eat it up. And I don't know, about a year to 2 years in, the pattern is I start to think, okay, well, what's my next step?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and start thinking about, do I move on? And, thinking about other places. So the pattern is it's hard for me to tell whether is it just my pattern, or is this. Really, I'm being moved somewhere else, based on some sort of other feeling.
So the question from David is, kind of notices a pattern that he gets into something, maybe a spiritual practice or a path or a job or a place or something, and it's usually a lot of excitement and interest, and then sort of finds a year, year and a half, 2 years later, it's sort of like, what's next, or ready to move on, and starts looking around. I guess your question is, is this okay, or is this normal, or is this pathological?
And also the wisdom to distinguish between is this, you know, this pattern, or is there something really that I need to move towards?
Well, again, you know, I'm always somebody, so once there is a pattern or something to really look at. I mean, I'm always interested in language because you opened the question by saying, I've noticed a pattern. Mm-hmm. So you sort of gave yourself away with that one.
Yeah.
And again, wisdom, insight, which isn't only, you know, at the profoundest levels, but at the psychological level and just everyday level, is when we can see the bigger picture, right? When we can rise above kind of our daily experience or our yearly experience and look for patterns, right? Look for deeper understanding, whether it's, you know, for whatever that can be applied. That's understanding, that's insight. And so obviously you're suspicious about David and his patterns. And again, it's always the interesting thing is, you know, what are you trying to get? You know, because sometimes what we find is, you know, it's like, you know, it's kind of the theme is always the same. You know what I mean? And the question is, you know, where am I trying to get to? What am I trying to get? Why is it I think I find it here, but then I don't. I think I'll go over here, and then I think I find it here, but then I, you know what I mean? And after a while, you begin to suspect there's something else going on here than just kind of ordinary life, you know. And that I may not, you know, I may be missing out on something. Right? And again, you know, it's your truth or understanding. You know, somebody else could be, you know, if they're stuck and trapped and stale and, you know, to keep, you know, to break out of a mold, to break out of something, you know, could be very helpful and meaningful. But when you're saying, well, I keep doing that, you know, and so maybe there's a bigger kind of mold, which is this whole pattern that I need to see into. You know, what is it that I want? You know, and that's a question, again, that one has to go deeply into oneself and try to, you know, separate the forest for the trees. And you know, not look at 2 years here, 2 years here, 2 years here, 2 years here, this relationship, this job, this place, this spiritual path. But you need to look at him or that which is going to all these places and doing nothing. You know, what is he up to? You know, because that's the key piece. What is he up to? What does he want? And what is, you know, and do I really understand him? Because, you know, we all have our external journeys, right? I mean, you know, each of us has our story, our drama, our you know, movement and relationships and jobs and places and, right? You know, all these things that we're right that we're moving through, but the key thing is, you know, he or she or that which is moving through this journey, that's in Dharma, that's the one we want to understand, right? Because you know, at the end of the road, you know, wherever the end of the, you know, your road comes, or the end of any of our roads come, which is death, obviously, you know, we'll all have done this and not done that. We'll have accomplished this and haven't accomplished that. We've succeeded here, we failed, you know what I mean? And that's just life, right? We all have our own stories. But what's meaningful is that, you know, the inside experience. What was that all about? Right? You know, some people don't ask these kind of questions until they're, you know, on their deathbed or at that place, you know what I'm saying, where all of a sudden they begin to look more deeply at their life. Obviously, someone who's, sincerely following a spiritual path, that's a question they ask early on. You know, and life is boring. Or no, that's not true. Life is not boring. There is boredom in life. And for some people, that's a hard one, right? Because One, we do have this kind of a wishful hope that, you know, life is really every day like going to Disneyland or something. You know what I mean? It's just you know what I mean? Or Epcot or just you know what I'm saying? It's that kind of childlike fantasy that we have about life. But also, again, you know, our culture is a highly stimulating culture, right? I mean, everything's just changing. You know, I mean, fashions change, cars change, ideas change, technology changes, bestsellers change. You know what I mean? Everything is constantly changing. Everything is new. You know, last year's fashion is not this year. Last year's best TV is not this year's. But you know, the pop song. There's so much change out there. Right? That somehow we, if we're not careful, we can take it inside and think that somehow, you know, but if you step back and go, oh yeah, there's all this change, is it really, how meaningful is any of that? Right? So this one's popular now and this one's not popular. I mean, so what? Right? You know, it's like, you know, this year, this is the best team. Last year it was the worst. Next year it'll be, you know what I mean? It's like in the moment, yeah, but in the bigger picture, it's... And so we want to make sure that, again, we're not getting addicted to the change and looking for meaning in the change, but looking more deeply. I said that in terms of, meditative practice, because, again... and maybe also this is what you're getting at. I mean, when something is new and fresh, because it is new, like it's a new job or a new relationship or a new car or a new house or a new project, there is some excitement in that kind of newness, right? But we know it is a short-lived kind of newness. Eventually, it begins to become normal. And if we're not careful, we can equate normal with boring, right? Which is very adolescent, right? If anybody remembers being a teenager, or has anybody been a parent of teenagers or a child, you know, I'm bored. This is a very common refrain. You know, I'm bored means what? You know, there's no stimulation, there's no excitement, there's nothing, you know. Like nothing's going on. But we know in our tradition that we're learning to see what's just going on is quite wonderful. Just breathing is quite wonderful. Just being alive is quite wonderful. Just being with people is quite wonderful. Just, you know, sky and, you know, the whole thing is quite wonderful. And it's a different kind of wonder than the wonder of, you know, doing something new all the time. You know, it's almost diametrically opposite, because it's a kind of happiness and joy and wonder that's just really almost in sameness. You know, it's like every day is a new day, right? And every day is a new day because every day is a new day. We've never been here, right? It's fresh and new. But in our culture, newness means, you know, new challenges, new opportunities, you know, new things to do. That's what gets us excited. You know, the freshness is, it is something new rather than just realizing this is a fresh moment. This moment has never been here. And it will never come again. And if I'm totally open and present to it, there is a deep wonder in this moment and freshness and aliveness, which is wonderful just in of itself. It doesn't have to be dressed up. Right? It doesn't need fancy packaging. It doesn't need neon lights. You know, fresh moment, fresh moment, fresh moment, you know, and bells. You know what I'm saying? I think what you're probably experiencing, and again, probably some of it is you too, is, again, very much our culture. You know, I mean, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, or I would say, you know, for probably many people in the world today, life is very much the same. You know, you get up in the morning, you go out in the fields, you come home and, you have your lunch, you get up the next day, and there is a kind of, people accept there is just a kind of ordinariness that this is what life's about. Right? I mean, in my yard, I have squirrels, lots of squirrels. I mean, they're excited all the time. They're running around and, you know, everybody observes squirrels. I'm having an opportunity to observe. I mean, they're just, they're highly excited. I mean, every day they come down those trees and they're looking around for their little nuts and, you know what I mean, and digging around, and then they bump, they run into each other and they're either happy or a little, they fight or they play with each other. And you know what I mean? They're like, they don't seem to get it that, they're doing the same damn thing every day. I mean, how do they do it? How are they so fresh? Because they're not thinking about past and future. They're not even, thinking about, I'm doing the same thing day after day. My parents, all the squirrels are doing this, I mean, if you think like that, you'd get depressed. And I don't know if squirrels get depressed. I mean, I don't know if there are mental health issues with squirrels, but they don't seem to. I mean, I don't know if it's joy what they're up to, but they're very alive, those squirrels. And that's only one little animal we're talking about. So, what is that? How can they just be okay with every day being okay? Because they take their pleasure in simplicity. So again, it's a certain way. I think the issue you're raising is a kind of spiritual or existential issue, but it's also, again, I think it's just very current in our time because we so are so overstimulated, and we are so told, it's all about challenges and overcoming challenges, and goals and objectives, and that's what life's about, and that's where happiness is. But we know it cannot. It's not producing happiness, because we know, on the happiness scales, things are not going up as we get busier and busier. People are not reporting they're happier and happier. I mean, if that was true, right? But it doesn't seem to be true. It's a good issue to look at. Any other questions anybody has? So let's look at Tahui. We've been reading Noel for a couple of months from his Swampland Flowers. Again, a very meaningful title, right? You've been in the swamp. Flowers bloom. Beautiful flowers can be found in the swamp. Even in a life that often has a lot of difficulty and suffering, obstacles and challenges, beautiful things can grow if we know how to cultivate them. So this is he was a quite well-known Chan Zen master. In the 12th century China. And this book, Swampland Flowers, is just a compilation of letters and lectures that he gave. So this is number 44, which is called Who is in the Way? And again, I'm not sure whether these title of the letters, I'm sure he didn't do this, so this is probably whoever compiled it. And these letters are in response to letters that he's received from students. So again, in those days, most Chan masters would live up in monasteries or up in the mountains, quite at a distance. So usually students came to them. they didn't go to them. They didn't go down to the cities, but rarely, but mostly people came to them. And so very common that if you were seeking out a teacher, a master, you might travel to his or her monastery and might stay there and receive teachings and practices, but then you would return home. And then probably the way they would communicate with their teacher for long periods of time, because it could only, they might only see them once a year, once every couple of years, obviously through this, is they would through letters, kind of bringing them up to date on their practice and letting them know. So this is, he's writing to one of his disciples, Li Mao Jia. And so the master writes, "Your letter informs me that your root nature is dim and dull, so that though you make efforts to cultivate and uphold the Dharma, you've never gotten an instant of transcendent enlightenment." So it must be that it sounds like this disciple wrote him a letter. It sounds like he was probably pretty discouraged. This was kind of a discouragement letter, right? He was probably discouraged with his meditation, his practice, his understanding, and I would say probably that's a mood or a feeling or something that is not unknown in this room, right? I think it's fairly common that people, people can get that way, in a meditation period where they sat down, they have every intention of sitting in mindfulness, and then 10, 15 minutes into it, they realize they haven't even found their breath yet, or they lost it after 2 seconds. They can go, "Oh God, what a joke I am! What a miserable practitioner! What a poor excuse!" So we can get down on ourselves and. And if it goes on long enough, we can think, "I just don't have it." Right? I'm just, like this guy must have said. It's interesting because in Buddhism we know, especially in the Zen tradition, the teaching is that all human beings, their root nature is this enlightened nature, right? Right? This totally awake nature. This all-wise, this is our true nature, our root nature. But in the letter, he informed the master that his root nature was dim and dull. So he's saying, I must be the exception to the rule. Right? It's sort of like, I understand in Buddhism, everyone has a Buddha nature, but somehow it skipped me or something. I have this dim and dull. So he's probably very discouraged in his practice. And he also must have said that even though he's tried and he's meditated and he's doing his best to live by the Buddha's teachings, and I haven't even gotten an instant of enlightenment. I mean, this guy would probably settle for an instant, much less a great enlightenment, but even just a moment of clarity, a moment of insight, right? He said, "I haven't even gotten that. That's that's what a dimwit I am." So it's interesting what the master says to him after this is his summary of the letter. He says, "The one who can recognize dim and dull is definitely not dim and dull. Where else do you want to seek transcendent enlightenment?" So this is very profound, right? Is that clear? And this is something all of us should reflect on. So he's writing the master and saying, "I'm a total spiritual failure, total dimwit, right?" And the master, rather than kind of, like somebody, some of us would say, "Oh no, you're not." We're so kind to people. We're so supportive. "Oh no, you're not. No, you're not dim. You're a good man and a good practitioner." And pat you on the head, and you've been practicing. You know what I mean? That's the way most of us go. Right? We're just nice people, and when we see somebody a little down on themselves, we want to what? We want to lift them up, right? We're nice people. But a Zen master is not interested in that. He's interested in what? She's interested in what? In liberating that person from their suffering. Right? Not just momentarily, picking them up off the floor, right? Which is nice. If somebody's fallen down, it is very nice to pick them up the floor, right? Pick them up off the floor. But if you realize you're only picking them off the floor to fall down again, right? 10 minutes later, they're going to be down again. Well, at some point, you might go, maybe picking them off the floor is not the kindest way. You know, maybe we got to look deeper at this issue. So again, please understand that in this tradition, compassion isn't always doing overtly the nice thing, right? Because sometimes, as we know, I mean, in our modern psychology self-help movement, we call always being nice is often what? Enabling, right? We know, everybody know that term, enabling, codependent. So there is a kind of a sophistication in the modern self-help psychological movement that somehow always being nice or accepting of kind of toxic or pathological or pain-producing behavior may not be the nicest thing. Right? To say to an alcoholic, oh, you're suffering so because you haven't had a drink today. Can I go get you one? Right? I mean, wouldn't that be a nice thing to do to somebody who was suffering? Right. But yet we know it's probably not the it's probably not the best thing if you really want to help them. Right? So it's sort of like that. Sometimes our normal kind of sentimental nice person kind of way of dealing with people may not actually be helping them. Now again, this isn't probably talking about, you know, people we run into the store or the street or people acquaintance, but this means when we're involved with somebody or we know them, right? And we really have the opportunity or want to be of help to them. So this is kind of an interesting point in what really is compassion and what really is the problem, right? Looking more deeply. So the first thing he says, the one who can recognize dim and dull is definitely not dim and dull. Okay? So he's totally done a 180, right? Because we're all focused on the poor guy who thinks he's dim and dull, right? Right? The dim and dull one. And what the master is saying, have you ever paid attention to that part of you that is looking at that other part and notices that he's dim and dull? What's that? Right? Right? So when you're going off and kind of, you know, just in your meditation, just going through what happened to you today, and all of a sudden something says, stop. Right? This is not helping you. Let's go back to the breath, right? What's that? Where's that coming from? There's a, you know, that part of you is kind of what? Kind of intelligent, isn't it? Interesting, right? I mean, he's saying, oh, all right, so a certain way you're going on is, we could call it dim and dull, but there's obviously another part of you that can see that clearly. Well, that part of you is obviously not dim and dull. Right? That part of you is probably what? Bright and sharp. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Here you are thinking you're the biggest dimwit in the world, and just the fact that there's a part of you knows that is pretty intelligent. I mean, does that make sense? This is important for all of us. Because we identify with what? Right? We identify with a part of ourselves, you know, that always screws up and makes mistakes and doesn't do, you know what I mean? That's the part. Rather than realizing, oh, there's another part of us that kind of knows the shortcomings of all that, can see it clearly. That part of us may not obviously be running the show. But in that moment, the master is saying, the one who can recognize dim and dull is definitely not dim and dull. The one who can see that you're not being mindful is obviously what? Mindful. Well, that's interesting. The one who's noticed that you're not aware is obviously aware. The one that's noticed that you're not being very compassionate obviously knows about compassion. Right? the one that knows that you're getting all bent or spin out of shape or attached to something and making a big drama about it, right, is obviously not caught up in that, is it? Because it can see it. Very interesting, isn't it? Where else do you want to seek transcendent enlightenment? All right? So this comes back to Swampland Flowers, right? Because this guy is seeking, you know, remember he said in his letter, he must have said, and here I've been practicing all these years, and I'm dumb and dull, and I haven't even gotten one instant of enlightenment. As if what? As if enlightenment is somewhere out there in the future, it's like a thing waiting for me that somehow I'm going to get.
Or something right? to achieve.
Or something to achieve, yeah, whatever. But it's outside of my present experience. And he's saying, you know, where else are you going to find an enlightenment other than in the midst of what's going on right now? And that part of you that can see clearly the way you're going on in this dim and dull way is maybe that is your enlightened aspect of yourself. And you don't even know it. Because you're so what? Identified with that part of yourself that you think is all screwed up. So then he goes on. After all, gentlemen of affairs who study this path, this is path with a capital T, this is, you know, the Buddha's way or the path of enlightenment or whatever. After all, gentlemen of affairs who study this path must depend on their dimness and dullness to enter. Okay? Why do we enter a spiritual path? Why do we meditate, right? Well, somebody might say, well, I'm learning to meditate because my mind's out of control and I want a more peaceful mind, right? All right, so you're entering meditation because you have an out of control mind. Right? That's the cause. So that's good, isn't it? Right? I want to enter a spiritual path, so I won't be unhappy and I can be happy. Well, unhappiness is your door for entering the path, isn't it? You see what I'm saying? So where he's saying wherever you're starting from, whatever that suffering, whatever that difficulty, whatever that, you know, that is what you must depend on to enter the path. What else is, you know, what else is driving you to it? So he's saying what? It's okay to be dim and dull. Because that dimness and dullness is what is moving you along. Now be careful. Somebody going, oh, then I'll just say dim and dull forever and just be aware of it. Sort of like Buddhism is like the Uber coping mechanism. Right. He says, but if you hold to dimness and dullness, considering yourself to be without the qualifications for the path, then you're being controlled by the demons of dimness and dullness. All right? So he says, you know, don't disparage or put down your dimness and dullness, right? Because that's what's, you know, gotten you here. That's fine. But now that you're here, you know, don't hold on to it. And begin to see and take it with you. So you think that you don't have any qualifications. Then you're being controlled by them. Is this clear? So, whatever it is in the swamp that has brought us to want to learn to be more mindful, want to meditate, want to be more compassionate, want to be more peaceful, want to have deeper well-being, want to understand things more deeply, want to awake, you know, whatever, want to be free, want to be, you know, whatever it is that has brought us, right? Don't disparage that. Don't be ashamed of that. In other words, don't be ashamed of your suffering. Don't be ashamed of your path. Don't be ashamed of where you are. Because all of that has brought you to here. Right? And that's good, isn't it? If you feel that what you're doing now is good, the steps you're taking. But he's saying, now, to kind of make that your basis as you travel the path, that's a big mistake. Right? So I think the question, and we'll see what he says. It's been a while since I've read this, so I'm learning as we go too. You know, this is why. See, in our culture, it is so easy to learn meditation. It's so easy to get involved in a spiritual path. Right? You don't have to do anything, do you? You know, you pick up your local freebie, or you go on the internet, you know, and you say, oh, Buddhism this, and you got 25 different kinds of Dharma groups, and Hindu, metaphysical, you know what I mean? You know, which one will I go to tonight? Right? It's easy, is it? You know, it's just really a matter of traveling 10 or 15 minutes or 20 minutes. Right? Or you don't even have to, do you? You can just do it on the internet, or go to Barnes & Noble or Borders, and, you know, I mean, it is so easy. It is so accessible that we just take all our garbage with us. Right? And we're doing the path just the way we've always done our life. Because it's, if you want to learn a meditative path, or you want to learn a Dharma path, or you want to learn a path of enlightenment, right? And you got to travel for 2 weeks into the mountains to go see a teacher, right? And you're in an unheated monastery, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it'll kind of have a deeper importance to you, won't it? You'll be very clear, you know, that something different is going on here. Because that encounter with your teacher in the Dharma is somewhat removed from your ordinary, everyday way of doing things. But the problem today is, you know, we can be totally in our ordinary, everyday, rushing around, crazy, self-absorbed life, and we can, you know, pick up a book, go to, you know, drop in on a meditation class on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock, right? For 2 hours and get a little bit of Dharma, get a little bit of meditation, and then leave here and go right back into our daily life, right? And we wonder why it's not really working. We wonder why I'm really not changing. I'm you know, I read this stuff, you know, how come I'm still struggling with the same problem, same issue, same neurotic self that I did for years ago? It's because I think what he's telling here. It's because we're holding on. I mean, again, dimness and dullness is just, you know, what was in this letter. But each of us have our own little phrase. Is that clear? Right? That's very personal to us. And again, we have to think, did I bring it all with me? Did I bring my low self-esteem with me? Did I bring my doubts, always doubting things with me? Did I believe my lack of trust or faith in myself? Did I bring my endlessly cynical, skeptical? Did I believe my, you know what I mean? What am I just bringing along with me? What? And I wonder why I can't get any traction. Well, there's no wonder, is it? You know? But if you hold to dimness and dullness, considering yourself to be without qualifications for the path, then you're being controlled by the demons. Right? And we know demons are what? Demons are those things that what? Upset you. You know, demons go around, I would imagine, demons are what? Things that just go around upsetting people, scaring people, right? Bothering them. So patterns in us become our demons when they have that capacity to disturb us, to prevent us from doing that which we know. That, you know, again, each of us, all of you are here, right? All of us here. We'll just take this little select group here tonight. There's obviously some kind of wisdom, right, that has brought each of us here that says something that goes on here, whatever it is good for me, right? I mean, am I right? I mean, is there anybody here thinking, I want to pick up some toxicity, I want to pick up some more deluded wrong views to increase my suffering in life? I mean, that's why I've come tonight. Right? No, we don't. We're here, whether we're conscious or not, thinking somehow this is going to be helpful to me. Right? Sitting, the Dharma talk, the teachings, the environment, being around other people. There's a part of us that knows that this is good for us, isn't it? Or will support things in us that we know are healthy for us, are good for us, or how we want to change our life. But yet, how many of us have really turned that corner in our life where that is consistent? You know what I'm saying? Where we're consistently involved in things that support and nourish that transformation. Since those with commonplace understanding often make the intention of seeking transcendent enlightenment into an obstacle set before them, they'll never get correct understanding. And this obstacle is not coming from the outside. It is nothing else but the boss man. This is an interesting translation. I have no idea what the actual Chinese is. But here is calling like our true self, or the self that knows, the boss man. And with a hyphen between boss and man. So the boss man is what? Who's the boss man, Jim? The boss is the guy who's in charge, right? All right? On the job, the boss man is the boss. He or she, boss woman, is the one in charge. And when you're working for the boss woman or boss man, you should what? Listen to them, right? Because they're the boss. They're the boss man. Again, I don't know what the Chinese really is. It sounds kind of funny. I don't know in English, or at least in American, I don't know what it sounds kind of funny. So that's the boss man. The boss man is coming from inside us. So this is not a superego. This is not an externally driven conscience or superego kind of societal kind of oppressing us with, you know, trying to be good. This is something that comes from the inside. We all have this because we all have this Buddha nature. We all have this nature that is beyond narcissistic self-absorbance. Right? We all have this nature that is interconnected, that is open and free and loving and accepting. That's our true nature. Right? So that's the boss man. Now the trouble is, for many of us, our boss man is just like, you know, it just pops out now and then. Or else it's there, but it's way back there. We don't hear it. So now he quotes, and again, this is a funny, because I remember when I learned this koan, he would call his own name. So here it says, this is in the letter he writes, thus when Master Jui Yen was dwelling constantly in his room, he would call to himself boss and also respond to himself, yes. And then the boss would say, be alert. And he would respond, I will. Hereafter, don't fall for people's deceptions. I won't. Now, the way this is usually translated the master would he lived alone, and those would hear his students or people outside the room would hear him. Let's say his name was Fred, he'd hear this say, "Fred, yes, wake up, yes, Fred. Don't be deceived by anything outside yourself. I won't." So it was that kind of dialogue.
Is this a common practice?
Well, for this teacher. No, this was teacher. But what Tawi says was, fortunately, he says, since ancient times, there have been such models as this. So again, he uses this to answer his, again, what we've been talking about, the boss man. He's really saying, you know, and it's really good for all of us. He's saying, you know, we should be having that kind of dial. He said, what a model, right? Every day he would say to himself when he woke up, Fred, you know, be alert. Go through the day alert. Yes, I will. Right? Don't be deceived by the comings and goings of people around you. I won't. Right? It's like having that kind of conversation with yourself where you are acknowledging that you have this, what's here called the boss man, or we could say a wise part of ourselves. And we let this part of ourselves what? Be the boss. Right? And we listen to the boss. Except most of us, it's not like that, is it? We listen to all the underlings. Right? You know, all of us have all this stuff in our head, all this nonsense, all this neurotic stuff, all this stuff from our childhood, all this kind of, immature, distorted, narcissistic, you know what I'm saying? Everybody know what I'm talking about, right? We have these voices within ourselves that are constantly, as we go through the day and having experience, manifesting in thoughts, telling us, you know, how, oh, I should be hurt at that, or I should tell that person what I really think, or I should, you know what I mean? Where's the boss? Where's the mature? Where's the wise? Where's the wisdom to say, you know, just let it be. It's nonsense. You know, is this bringing you any closer? Is this making you happy? Right? Staying angry, making you happy? Staying worried, making you happy? Is this how you cultivate calmness? Right? See, that's an interesting dialogue to have with yourself. I think he's holding up this little famous dialogue of this master who would have this dialogue with himself as an example of somebody who just, you know, every day, right out there, you'd hear him in his room. He wasn't ashamed to kind of, he knew he had to keep himself on track. You know, as I go through the day, there are many parts of myself. Which one's the boss? Right? I think it's a question we all need to ask ourselves. Is my mature, wise, selfless, compassionate, you know, and all those good things, is that the part of me? Is that the boss? Right? Or, you know, is it anarchy? Is it whoever yells loudest? Right? Whoever makes the most noise, whoever's got the most emotion behind them, right? Is that who runs the show? Who's ever most persistent? If you remember a couple of months ago when we were reading Empty Cloud, Suyin, remember we were reading him and he had that whole section on host and guest? Do you remember that? Or again, same kind of thing, right? You know, what do you identify? Do you identify with the host or the guest? Do you remember that? I don't know if all of you were there. It's very profound, right? Because again, the host stays. The host lives in the house. Guess what? Come and go. Right? You know, they come for a meal, they come for an hour, they come for a day, they come for a week, but they go. The host stays. Thoughts, feelings, constantly coming and going, right? In our awareness, in our mindfulness, we see thoughts, feelings, perceptions, coming and going, sensations coming and going, right? They're the guests. They don't stay. So why do we get so bent out of shape, so absorbed, right? You know, over these guests that are only coming and going. They don't even stay, you know, more than a minute. A thought. How long does a thought last? How long does a feeling last? And yet, we're totally absorbed in them. We don't, again, it's like the master did here today. He said, you know, the host, what is it that's aware of the thoughts? You know, what is the medium through which thoughts are arising and passing? Right? Who is it that's watching the thoughts? Why don't you identify with that one? That one has objectivity, right? If you can say, wow, there's a part of me that's really angry. There's a part of me that's really hurt. There's a part of me that's really jealous. There's a part of me that's really scared, right? Well, right then you have observed what? There's a part of you that's able to be aware of that part of you that is suffering. Right? Well, which one do you identify with? Do you identify with the host or the guests? Guests come and go. Right? Every day, a different drama. 20 times a day, different dramas. Right? That's all we're dealing with. And everyone is so important to us. And we can't even keep track of all the dramas that we've been so bent out of shape about in our life. Right? How many people remember the drama that they were concerned about a week ago Tuesday? Is anybody aware of it? We laugh. Why? And yet, you know what? There's a good chance it was a drama that was very important to us. Right? Something we were a little upset about or concerned about, or, you know, somehow bent out of shape about. And yet we can't even remember it, can we? Or the drama from the day before, the drama from the day after. It's like that. One who does, he says, just arouse yourself right here and see what it is. You know, see what it is that is the one who's arousing you, energizing you, inspiring you. The one who recognizes dimness and dullness. Do you know that part of yourself? And the one who recognizes dimness and dullness isn't anyone else. He or she is your own fundamental identity. Please consider this deeply. This part of you, no matter how screwed up you may think, this part of you that has the capacity of seeing that, this is your, you know, this is your, this is an aspect of your true self. It can see clearly. Right? When are we going to start cultivating and identifying with that part of ourselves and not with the part of ourselves that's problematic? They both exist right now, no matter how screwed up you are. Right? Even for a moment, if you can see it, you know you have that capacity. Right? To be objective. To be clear. Right? What is that capacity that each of us have? Do you know it? Do you know it well? Or are you like this guy who wrote the letter, who only really seems to know his dim and dull and poor me, and I'm terrible, and I'm the worst practitioner in the world, and I'm hopeless, right? Is that the part you identify with? Have you dragged that part of you along to be in charge of your spiritual life? Because if we have, we're making a big mistake. Anyhow, he goes on like that. Are there any questions about this? This is a very wonderful teaching from the master, 12th century. That's what? 900 years ago or 809 years ago? Shows you things haven't changed much. Fundamental truths are the same. Human beings still at the deepest level are dealing with the same issues in terms of their desire to be free, happy, liberated from suffering. So is anything not clear about the teaching that was shared with us tonight by Master Tahui? So good. Please, hopefully, when you all wake up in the morning, have a little conversation with yourself. Yeah. If you live with other people, they may think it's a little strange, but they'll get used to it after a while. Just say you were talking on your cell phone or something. That's who you were talking to. What's that little earpiece called that people have? Or Bluetooth. You just were talking in your Bluetooth. They overheard you. It's funny, you can talk into your Bluetooth and just be babbling away and loud voice, and that's normal. But if you talk directly to yourself out loud, then you're somehow abnormal. It's kind of a strange world we live in, isn't it? Good, so why don't we stop here? Thank you. And we will continue in 2 weeks.